Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is March 15th, 2022. And our first order of business is to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher. Schumacher. Ackland.
Present.
Becker. Becker.
Becker present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Keel. Keel. Morrison.
Morrison present.
Munson.
Munson present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott. Wolgamott. A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. And of course, as members become visible or audible to us, they'll be marked present as well. Okay, great. So now I'm going to go to Representative Ryer to make a motion on the minutes of March 14th. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the minutes of March 14th for approval.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of March 14th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. So the first bill that we have on the agenda for today is House File 4103, Representative Hewitt, and the motion on 4103, Representative Hewitt's motion would be for 4103 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Is that your motion, Representative Hewitt?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Very good. And I did not see any author's amendments, so I think we're good to go. Yes?
There is no okay. Author's amendments.
All right. So please go ahead, Representative Hewitt, present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 4103 provides a much needed funding to support our local public health agencies prepare for and respond to public health emergencies. Currently, our state preparedness activities are funded entirely by the federal government with no state level investment in the program. This bill commits state funding to ensure, regardless how the federal funding may fluctuate over time, that our local public health has a strong base of funding to do the important emergency preparedness and response work. Public health emergency preparedness funding supports response to a wide variety of public health emergencies, whether it's an infectious disease outbreak such as COVID-19 or things like natural disasters. Even terrorism is responded to. This crucial program is a key for the continued COVID-19 response, but also future emergencies. Past funding cuts at the federal level have resulted in less staff time for capacity for agencies to respond to emergencies. In our smallest rural areas, our preparedness staff persons may be split their time between multiple counties covering large geographical areas in larger communities. One to two staff are expected to cover an emergency response for a large population of individuals. I have two testifiers here today to speak to the bill. They can also answer questions. Madam Chair, the testifiers are, I'm gonna let them say their own names. I'm not gonna hash them. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So first we have Liz Ock. I may be saying it wrong, but welcome to the committee and please state your name for the record and go ahead and tell us who you are and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Liz Auch, A-U-C-H.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Liz Oak, and I am the administrator of Countryside Public Health, Big Stone, Chippewa, Lac qui Parle, Swift, and Yale Medicine counties. I also serve as the legislative committee co-chair of the Local Public Health Association. The Local Public Health Association represents 240 public health directors, supervisors, community health administrators across all 87 of our counties, cities, and tribes. And I am here today to speak in support of House File 4103. The bill will provide much needed funding to support our local public health emergency preparedness infrastructure. And we thank Chair Liebling, members of this committee, and Representative Hewitt on this critical issue. Responding to a disaster and emergency is a mandated responsibility of Minnesota's local public health departments. So in Minnesota, federal funding comes in, it goes to the state, and then the state will allocate it to our local public health departments. Now, although there was a one-time investment in some of our emergency preparedness activities because of COVID-19, historically though, federal funding has been cut drastically. $16 million is what we received in 2002. We are now down to $9.2 million in 2021. And although the funding was cut, the expectations did not reflect that. So local tax levy has been expected to fill the gap. So to give you a perspective for me at Countryside Public Health, in 2002, I got $111,768. And in 2020, I received $71,115, so a 36% cut in the middle of this pandemic. I have one FTE to plan, respond, and prepare for public health emergencies across five counties. We are asking the state to invest public health emergency preparedness funds, direct them to local public health so we can rebuild that emergency response infrastructure. Public health emergency preparedness funding is incredibly important to local public health, and I thank you so much for your consideration on this bill.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Auk. And next we have Christine Lees. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Liebling and members of the committee, my name is Christine Lees, L-E-E-S. And I am the Disease Prevention and Control Environmental Health Supervisor, as well as previously the Emergency Preparedness and Response Supervisor at Dakota County Public Health. Local health departments have stepped up in a remarkable way during the COVID-19 pandemic while simultaneously responding to other health-related emergencies, such as tuberculosis contact investigations. Effectively responding to public health emergencies is critically important to the well-being of our communities and our economy. Federal preparedness grants have guided the work we have done for many years to prepare such events. However, our funding has been cut every year since 2005, which has decreased our infrastructure and ultimately did impact our ability to respond to this pandemic. In Dakota County, we serve a population of more than 425,000 residents and have only 2.4 FTE dedicated to public health emergency preparedness. Our funding has decreased from a peak of $475,000 in 2005 to $265,000 in 2020. Because of this decrease, we have continually had to cut FTE as well as shift emergency preparedness staff to take on non-emergency preparedness work. During the COVID-19 pandemic, 144 of our staff, nearly 100%, were redirected to COVID response activities. Local public health is the boots on the ground, and all responses end up being local. We take MDH and CDC data and recommendations and respond by putting interventions into action. In Dakota County, that has included answering more than 3,000 calls on our public health hotline, distributing over 7,000 rapid tests to schools and nonprofits, and setting up over 1,000 vaccine clinics and giving over 75,000 immunizations. We've seen the devastating impacts of this pandemic and will likely feel them for years to come. Many critical areas of public health were neglected because of our workforce shortage. Building up our public health infrastructure for emergency response is key to future responses. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Lees. Are there questions from members? Okay. I don't see any. Oh, yeah. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to hear from the testifiers, Ms. Oak and Ms. Lees, you know, if this bill goes through and they get the funding, what are some of the first things they need to do to reinvigorate the public health? And I think all members, you know, maybe we're just all quiet on this issue because we've realized during a pandemic that it's a really bad idea to cut public health. And I think we're all probably more connected to public health than we ever have been in our lives. And I want to just say thank you to Rep. Hewitt for bringing the bill forward. So I'll leave it at that and let them answer that question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Ms. Auk, maybe you're the person to go to on this.
Well, I'll answer that as best I can, Madam Chair and committee members. One of the two areas, having five counties, one way I would respond to you with this increase in funding. I will tell you during the pandemic, three of my counties had a better response to the pandemic with our emergency preparedness and our hospitals and clinics. And two of my counties, because of the cuts and the staffing, two of my counties did not have quite the response, and I would say the ability to respond in the way that they needed to. And I don't know if I want to out those counties on the call here, but two of my counties. So what would I do? I immediately infused some dollars into two of those counties to really beef up that response, because three of my counties have a really good response and staffing capacity to handle things. Two of my counties, with all the cuts, I did not have the staff capacity to really navigate the exercises and the drills that needed to be done with previous, because emergency preparedness dollars is about exercising and preparing and being ready. And so two of those counties did suffer a bit with the cut. So that would be one of the places I would start with those dollars. And I thank you for the question, Representative Robert Bierman, and I hope I didn't say your name wrong. Thank you for the compliment, by the way, too. Sometimes I'm afraid to say what I do. I was gone a couple of days and someone said, what do you do? And I'm like, I don't know if I want to tell you. So thank you for the compliment.
All right, Representative Bierman, follow up, and you are muted.
Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you for the good answer, Ms. Elk. That's exactly what I surmised you might say, is it's the preparedness side. And I know how well prepared the county was where I reside, and I hope it is the same across the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. And I have a question as well, probably for Ms. Auk again. But so I'm looking at the bill, and the bill is for a $9 million appropriation each year going into the base. And I'm just wondering, I don't see anything about how it's distributed. And it goes to the Commissioner of Health to be distributed to local and tribal public health organizations. Is the intention that it be distributed by population, or by, is there any, you know, what was the thinking about how it would be distributed under the bill? Ms. Auk.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'm just going to plead, I don't exactly know. Let me be very candid and honest. I do know the bill says 90% would go to local public health and 10% to the state. There is a funding formula work group that has existed over the years, Madam Chair, that was used as the funding kept getting cut. They would go back to this funding formula work group. I don't know if that funding formula work group would be implemented again so that we could look at distributing in a way that is equitable across the state. But I definitely, that's a state question. But I definitely wanted you to know, I've been around long enough to know there's definitely funding formula work groups that exist, and I could see that probably happening again. That is definitely a guess, for the record.
All right. Well, thank you for that, because you do remind me that there is indeed a formula. And let me just see if we have fiscal staff on that could maybe, if they know.
Excuse me, Carrie, my boss. My boss said there is an existing funding formula that we would use.
Okay, all right, thank you. Because I know there is one for local public health. Clearly, there is, and I just wasn't sure if this funding then would. Oh, and here's Ms. Clarkfist. I think she might be prepared to answer. She's probably trying to look in the statutes and see what's in there. Ms. Clarkfist.
Madam Chair and members, I was just going to point out that the funding formula for local public health grants is in section 145A.131.
And Ms. Clarkfist, so I assume that this would go according even though this is designated as emergency preparedness and response, a little different from just general local public health funding, but it would go according to the same formula, I assume?
It could. I think that's a question for the health department, Madam Chair.
Okay, and there's Lisa.
Hi, Madam Chair. Lisa Timian, Legislative Director at MDH. I believe Cheryl Peterson-Krober is on, and she's our Emergency Preparedness Director at the agency. So I'm hoping she can chime in to confirm all of this.
Okay, all right. I didn't mean for this to be such a deep question, but go ahead, please, if you can answer the question.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Liz and Christine, for sharing your stories. What we have done with emergency preparedness is we do not use the exact same formula that is used for the block grant money that is listed. We do have a formula that includes both population, geography. It looks at other high vulnerability of the social vulnerability indexes. And so those are, I would say it's not a simple formula, but it is one that the FEP oversight group, which is a subset of the SHAC work group, agreed upon, and that's what we've been using to distribute those funds.
Thank you. And could you just state your name and title for the record so that we can be sure to have that?
Certainly. It's Cheryl Peterson-Krober, and I'm the Director of Preparedness and Response at MDH.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Great. So Representative Hewitt, final word before we lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. And I never seen call a friend, so it worked so well there on that last part. So that's great that the department was here. Our current model for preparedness is not working, and we need to upgrade it. This is a really good opportunity for us to look at this. I've trained myself on disaster drills, and I never thought I would see one in my lifetime. And here we are sitting in the middle of one. This takes all of us into consideration, and we need to make sure that we fund it well. Thank you, members, and thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Hewitt, and thank you, testifiers. So House File 4103 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 4099. Representative Moran, Chair Moran, welcome.
Well, good afternoon,
Chair. Good afternoon. And since you're not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 4099 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And I understand there is an author's amendment. And did you want to move that right away to get the bill in shape?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, so I will move that then for Representative Moran, the A2 author's amendment. And so we'll adopt that, and then we'll discuss the bill in the form in which the author would wish. So all in favor of adopting the A2 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Moran, to your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to come before your committee to have House File 4099 heard. Really quick about the amendment is a very simple amendment. On page 1 of line 8, after commissioner, we insert the word of health. On page 1 of line 9, we delete the word purpose, and we insert purposes and delete is and insert are. On page 2 of line 8, we delete the early learning council, and we insert the word advisory council to the children's cabinet. In line 2 of line 18, we delete of and insert for. And finally, Madam Chair, on page 3 of line 5, we delete the word community solution. So a little bit to the bill. The Community Solution Grant Program was first passed in 2019. This historic program focuses on improving measures of well-being for children of color and American Indian children in Minnesota prenatal to age 8 through a community and equity center approach across the state. By the year 2035, 1 in 4 children in our state will be a child of color. They are the future leaders of our state, but do we have programs and systems that are inclusive of the needs of all our children? Well, the Community Solution Grant Program is a strategy by which we can begin to address disparities in Pacific communities in an upstream way. When we think about housing, education, public safety, and really all of our systems, a lot can be achieved when we center the needs of children and families early on in life. It leverages the assets in the community to address their problems. It brings those who are most impacted into the decision-making process. So specific to the bill, the grants are awarded to organizations that focus on improving healthy child development outcomes for communities of color and American Indian communities with an emphasis on prenatal to grade three. The possible outcomes include early learning, health and well-being, economic security, and safe, stable, nurturing relationships and environment. Eligible grantees include organizations, nonprofits, or tribal nations that are either led by or directly work with communities of color and American Indian community. Geographic equity in grant disbursement is ensured by prioritizing grantees located in regions in the state with high populations of communities of color or American Indians. Grants will be administered by the Minnesota Department of Health in consultation with the Community Solution Advisory Council that is comprised of parents, advocates, and leaders from community-rooted institutions. The council and the staff at MDH, which provide critical support for grantees and other agencies, have also learned from this process and have begun to adapt practices to their programs. And I will stop there, Madam Chair. And I do believe I may have a couple of testifiers. And I ask Madam Chair and the members to look. We have a huge amount of support that has come about between 2019 and today with the grants that have gone into these organizations.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Moran, Chair Moran. And so I have two testifiers on my list here. And the first is has an Ojibwe name, which I dare not pronounce, but please welcome Nicole. That part I can pronounce, but welcome to the committee. And please say your name for us and tell us where you're from and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Nicole Neeland, K-N-E-E-L-A-N-D. I work for Fond du Lac Tribal College located in Cloquet, Minnesota for an organization called Ojibwe Motari Da Oma Girikimina. Our organization's work is language and culture revitalization. Today, I'll share a little bit more about our language immersion nest called Gukunanik in Dawad, or grandmother's house, grandma's house, which is a beneficiary of the Community Solutions Grant Program. Grandma's house brings elder first speakers together with both the parents and children of ages 0 to 5 years old in a cooperative home-like environment. This three-generational language revitalization approach is for parents to be able to raise children with clear and uncompromising Ojibwe identities so they have heightened resilience against the mental and emotional challenges they will face growing up as an Indigenous person. Because of this support, our parents have been able to continue language and culture immersion at home, overcoming a large barrier experienced by other programs that have not been able to engage parents with their children. Our program is succeeding because parents are directly involved, and they are able to be involved because of the support from Community Solution. By helping to build strong identities in the early years, the children of BIPOC communities in Minnesota can build better resilience to the mental, emotional, and physical challenges they will face as they mature. Community Solutions is helping to address health inequities among its Indigenous citizens by strengthening the ability of parents to raise children in their native language and culture. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Diane Halsey. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Diane Halsey, and I'm the executive leader of family engagement at Think Small. And I'm also the co-chair of the Voices and Choices for Children Coalition. Voices and Choices is a coalition that is focused on improving outcomes for children of color and American Indian children ages 0 to 8. We are focused on the implementation of policies and practices that meaningfully address the disparities that exist in the state of Minnesota. We support House File 4099 because we believe it is a strategy that addresses inequities found in communities across Minnesota. Minnesota has persistently had the worst achievement gaps between BIPOC children and white children in the country, including health and developmental outcomes. And these gaps start at birth. The recent report from the Minnesota Department of Education has proven that we have not created the solutions to move the needle on this gap. It is also good to know that the state surplus is in large part to the fact that the challenges we faced during the pandemic resulted in significantly less spending by the Department of Education because we have lost many of our Black and Brown children. Our communities of color and Native American nations have many solutions to build upon and edify children and families, but do not have the funds and resources to implement and sustain those efforts. The Community Solutions Fund will do just that. You have just heard from one of the grantees, but there are 22 other current grantees that are doing amazing work, and 12 of them have submitted letters of support. We are asking for $20 million based on the demand that we saw in the response to the first RFP. We strongly encourage you to support House File 4099. The collective health and collective prosperity of our state is ultimately tied to children of color and American Indian children thriving. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Halsey. Appreciate your testimony. Are there any other, are there questions for members? Questions, discussion? Okay, I'm not seeing any. Let me just say that to Ms. Neeland, the program that you described and the idea of reviving language and culture by bringing together the generations, that just gives me the chills, honestly. I think it sounds absolutely great. And I suppose especially, and I know members know this, but especially because of what was done to Indian people, right? Which was the splitting up of families. And so it's a kind of repair, or at least attempt to beginning of repair, that is very moving in light of the history. So best wishes to you on that. It's really wonderful. And I know that's just one example of the kinds of programming you all are talking about. So Representative Moran, final word on the bill? Oh, you are muted.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Members, we know that in Minnesota, that we are known for a lot of good stuff. And many other states look to us for best practices and how we're moving in our state to create great outcomes. But also in the state of Minnesota, we're known for having some of the worst disparities in the nation. And I know we can do better. And House File 4099 is a solution to turning the disparities into achievement and starting early. I ask for your support of House File 4099.
Thank you very much, Chair Moran, for bringing this bill. And so House File 4099 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, testifiers. Next, we are going to go to House File 4063. House File 4063, which is Representative Ryer. And so Representative Ryer moves that House File 4063 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And I see there's a DE1, and Representative Ryer, I will leave it to you whether you want to move that now, explain it first, or how you want to handle it.
Madam Chair, let's move it now, and then I'll speak to the bill.
Okay, so Representative Ryer is moving the DE1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like to discuss it. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Ryer, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm here today to talk about House File 4063, a bill that requires hospitals to help patients get all of the financial assistance that they're entitled to in order to avoid medical debt. Medical debt is one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in our country. And we often hear of patients with medical debt who haven't received aid that was available to them, which can then lead to bankruptcy as well as a great deal of personal stress. This is an avoidable issue that we have the means and the responsibility to take on. One simple step that this bill proposes is to ensure that patients and their families get the information they need to determine eligibility. In House File 4063, we make it part of the hospital's responsibility to screen uninsured patients for eligibility for a variety of public programs and hospital charity care programs. The other important step is providing assistance in applying for the aid they're eligible for. These tend to be complex processes, and the barriers can be daunting for English language learners, people with less education, or with other challenges. Our bill requires the hospital to help or connect the patient with someone who can assist them. In short, this program requires hospitals to offer some basic steps to give their patients the resources they need. Our goal is a program that helps hospitals help patients. This is also in the interest of hospitals who will benefit by having less unpaid medical debt on their books. We've met with the Minnesota Hospital Association, who suggested some changes, and with the DE amendment in place, they have no concerns about this bill. I'd like to turn it over now to our testifiers to explain the program in more detail. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. So we have first Anne Odegaard. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. We call it MABC. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. MABC is a racially and geographically diverse coalition of nonprofit organizations. We have about 135 members across the state. And they're working to create economic opportunities for lower income Minnesotans and advance racial equity. In 2018, prior to the COVID pandemic, the National Financial Capability Study reported that 750,000 Minnesotans, or about 17% of Minnesota adults, had medical bills and collections. It's likely that number is higher today. One way to protect families from the emotional and financial stress of unaffordable medical bills is to make sure every family knows what assistance programs are available, whether they may qualify, and how to apply. Of medical debt referred to the state for collection, over half of claims are against families with income below $30,000 per year, many of whom were likely eligible for some kind of assistance, but for some reason weren't covered. As Representative Ryer said, House File 4063 requires hospitals to screen uninsured patients for eligibility in public health care programs, such as medical assistance and Minnesota Care, and for the hospital's own discounted care program. If the patient appears eligible, the bill requires hospitals to either assist the patient with an application or to connect the patient to a navigator service. The bill specifies that hospitals may use the federal hospital presumptive eligibility determination process, or another similar screening process. Presumptive eligibility is a federal program that allows hospitals to qualify patients for temporary medical assistance coverage based on an abbreviated screening process. About two-thirds of Minnesota hospitals already participate in that program, so many have staff protocols in place that would meet most of the requirements of this bill. In general, we know our hospitals are doing a good job of connecting people to the help they need. But MABC members working with low-income communities are often called on to help those who, for some reason, fell through the cracks. And once the medical debt is set to a collection agency or affects a person's credit report or is put on a credit card as a last resort, it's generally too late to apply for assistance. Thank you so much to Representative Ryer for your leadership on this bill and to Chair Liebling for hearing the bill. And thanks, of course, to the Minnesota Hospital Association for working collaboratively with us on the first draft. I'd like to turn it over to our next testifier, one of MABC's members who has been a strong advocate for people struggling with medical debt.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, I have Nadine Gall. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Nadine Gall, and I work for Lutheran Social Services as a certified financial counselor. At LSS, we provide free financial counseling to anyone in the United States, regardless of their income. However, in 2021, 74% of our clients were Minnesota residents, and most have low to middle incomes. I frequently work with Minnesotans whose medical debt adds to the stress of paying their regular bills. Their medical bills typically have high balances, which means a monthly payment that they cannot afford. Debts that are unpaid or have missed payments are then sent to collections, which greatly increases the financial strain even more. They impact the ability to secure housing, affordable auto insurance, jobs, lower interest rates, or even access to credit when they need it. Many uninsured clients do qualify for financial assistance programs if they know to ask. When we're working with clients who have low income and high medical debt, my colleagues and I always ask if they have applied for any kind of assistance, and the response is almost always that they didn't even know it was available. Unfortunately, by the time those clients reach out to us, their financial assistance options are almost always expired. Medical assistance only covers 3 months of previously uninsured care, and once a hospital writes off a debt, it's sent to an outside collection agency and is too late to apply for help. I hope the legislature will pass this bill, because having our hospitals regularly screening all uninsured patients for financial assistance, medical assistance, emergency medical care, and charity care, fewer Minnesota families will face the financial hardship and stress from medical debt. Thank you for your time.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Gall, for your testimony. Are there questions for members? Representative Bonner.
More of a comment than a question, but I want to thank Representative Ryer for bringing this bill forward, and Ms. Odegaard. You know, my mom, I've said to many, has worked at the county for 43 years. And as a safety net hospital, I can tell you that in their particular population, this was a huge issue. And on more than one occasion, my mother would come home and discuss having to walk a patient or their family through how to get assistance. And this is really just a common sense measure that makes sense. It makes sure that hospitals can remain whole. It makes sure that patients get the best outcomes that they can, and of course, avoid unnecessary medical debt. It just makes sense from one end of the spectrum to the other. So thank you for the bill. Obviously, you can tell I am a supporter, and I will be voting yes.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing the bill forward. So could you remind, I think we heard in the testimony, how many hospitals or systems are not doing this right now? And just to kind of go back to that part of it, and then how quickly can we get these other systems on board? Because it seems surprising that that it was not done, you know, before this time, and that bringing the attention reminds us when there is assistance out there. You know, that seems like a much better solution for everybody than loading an individual up with debt.
Yeah. So who should answer that question? Representative Ryer?
Madam Chair, I'll refer that to Ms. Odegaard, please.
Oh, okay. Ms. Odegaard.
Madam Chair, thank you so much. And thank you for the question. So I have the data from DHS on hospitals in Minnesota that participate in the federal presumptive eligibility program, which is similar in that it allows hospitals to do that screening. And then if they determine that someone is presumptively eligible, they can immediately qualify for that temporary Medicaid. And it's about two-thirds, I think the exact number is 103 hospitals in Minnesota do participate in that HPE program, and about 40 something don't. So what I quoted was about two-thirds do participate. But the HPE program does not actually require hospitals to screen. We know some are doing a fantastic job. I assume that most are doing their best at it, but we'd really like to make sure that those couple people that are falling through the cracks really do get screened for eligibility for the programs.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, Representative Pryor? No, okay. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ryer, thank you for bringing this bill forward. you know, I think I just like your goal so much, just to help hospitals and patients with medical debt. And with the large numbers we see, I mean, this is really a good step toward, you know, taking care of, or at least addressing the issue. I think I heard someone mention that 17% of patients have medical debt that is, affected, and that we do need to do something. But I did have a question for Ms. Odegaard, specifically regarding the presumptive eligibility issue. And I'm wondering if this bill will address that in any way going forward, if folks who didn't get signed up or acknowledged could with this bill.
Ms. Odegaard?
Thank you. I want to clarify your question a little bit. Do you mean the patients that haven't been enrolled in a public program or financial assistance, could they then be enrolled after this with this legislation? Or are you talking about the hospitals themselves?
Provided the patient qualifies and they weren't aware of it and they got billed differently, could they retroactively apply with the passage of this bill?
Ms. Odegaard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my understanding is that for medical assistance, and I think Nadine mentioned this, they will cover back 3 months of bills once somebody is determined to be eligible. So I think what the credit counselors are seeing is that by the time somebody reaches out to help because they're struggling with their debt, it's often more than 3 months. And so this would not change the actual parameters of when Medicaid could cover back medical bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one other question as we're talking about this and hearing about the number of hospitals that are engaged in this program, are being participating in, you know, really helping clients. Do we track in the state of Minnesota by facility the numbers, or the, you know, if there's one facility that has a much higher rate of having patients come out with medical debt, is that something that the state knows about at this point, or is that not measured?
Ms. Odegaard, would you know that, or probably would be somebody from MDH, I assume, we might need to call on if you don't know that. And I don't know if, Lisa Timian, I don't know if she would know that off the top of her head either, but what a great question. If we don't, I wish we did. Ms. Timian, do you know the answer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Timian at MDH Legislative Director. I do not know the answer, but we'd be happy to get back to you and look into this.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you for that great question. And I look forward to hearing the answer to that as well. And I have a question, too, if none of the other members have any more questions. Let me see. Let me give a call for other questions here. Okay, I have a question too, and I don't know if you can answer this one, Ms. Odegaard, but I'm interested in the charity care programs, and I wonder if you have found that hospitals, I'm sure there's a wide variety of them across hospitals. I'm not aware that there's some sort of standard charity care program, and I wonder what you can tell us about what those consist of, how hard they are to qualify for, et cetera. And if there is, if you know of data about that, can you help me with that one?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. Yes, you're right that each hospital has its own charity care policy and eligibility parameters. And so there's not a uniform standard across the state. Each hospital is required under federal law to have information about their policy on their, you know, easily available. Most of them have it on their website. I have done some research just kind of popping up hospital by hospital to see, you know, what is generally available. Some set, for instance, a federal poverty level of 200% or 250%, but it really does vary by hospital. Hospitals also do have to report annually on how much charity care they offer. And so again, hospital by hospital, you can look up that number, but I haven't done that for all 140 some hospitals in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. And let me just also ask Ms. Timian whether the department collects that. And you know, this is, it's great that it's out there, but, you know, having somebody, just an interested party go and look hospital by hospital is one way, but Ms. Timnyan, do you know if the department actually collects that information?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will look into that. Again, I'm sorry I do not have the answer in front of me, but I'll get back to you because I also find charity care a very interesting topic.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And I know we can't, it's not fair of us to expect you to know everything that might touch on the Department of Health because it is vast. So I know that you're close to that, but not 100%. So very good. So with that, are there any other questions for members? Okay, Representative Ryer, final word on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks to everyone for your insightful questions and support for this program. I too think it's common sense. I think it's an easy step. I am very appreciative that the Minnesota Hospital Association also collaborated with us, as Ms. Odegaard said. There's a lot of value in saying, here's the process we're going to follow. Here are the standards that we're going to have. The hospitals that are farther down the path in using the federal program, we can ensure consistency there as well as bringing along the others. So I thank you all and look forward to this moving forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer, and testifiers. Really appreciate it. And with that, House File 4063, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So now we're going to turn to Representative Sandell's bill, House File 3114. And this was heard in the Preventive Health Division. So we have a division report, and Chair Freiberg is going to move the division report to get that before us. So the motion is to adopt the division report on House File 3114. Representative Freiberg, are you available? Okay.
Madam Chair, if he's unavailable, I would be happy to move it.
Okay, very good. So Representative Bierman is going to move the move to adopt the division report on 3114. So all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the division report is adopted. And then I'm going to also let Representative Bierman, if you would like to make the motion. The motion will be for House File 3114 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So,
yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to make the motion to lay the bill over, House File 3114, for inclusion in our House file.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So, members, this bill is now before us. I do want to note that it did receive a full hearing in the Preventive Health Division, and we have that division for the purpose of hearing bills. We don't have to rehear the whole bill. This is not a second complete hearing. This is just a brief hearing to get it available to this committee for our finance bill. So, but we do have some testifiers, and so I'm going to ask them to be very brief since the bill has already had a full hearing. So first of all, to you, Representative Sandell, to present your bill.
Well, thank you, Chair Liebling, and Representative Bierman, members and staff. It's really a pleasure to be here today with a group of people who believe as firmly as I do that healthy children are best prepared for the challenges of learning, possibilities before them, and the lives that they'll lead. House File 3114 is the blueprint for a network of school-based health centers imagined and modeled already in 27 Minnesota schools, many more across the nation, and ready to grow where invited. School-based health centers are a collaboration of healthcare professionals, school districts, state agencies, public and private administration, and insurance providers to benefit all children and their families. Our testifiers will tell you how the pieces fit together. They'll offer evidence of how attentive and accessible healthcare strengthens children, their classroom achievement, and their future as independent and engaged citizens. Madam Chair, I'd like to begin our testimony with an introduction by Shauna Hedlund, Executive Director of the Minnesota School-Based Health Alliance. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Sandell. And I had a slightly different order, but your plan was to have Ms. Hedlund start, that's okay with me. Ms. Hedlund, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shauna Headland. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota School-Based Health Alliance. And House File 3114 will provide funding to school-based health initiatives, support quality care in school-based clinics, and formalize the long-term relationship between the Minnesota School-Based Health Alliance and our Department of Health. This bill allows us to optimally respond to the increasing healthcare needs among students by expanding upon a well-researched and firmly established healthcare access model that was developed here in Minnesota in the 1970s. They are an effort between volunteering school districts and clinics to decrease the responsibility on schools to provide clinical health care, and they do not replace the key allied wellness support within schools, such as licensed school nurses and school counselors. I am happy to answer any questions about the alliance, but I think I'll move here quickly to say 50 years of stability, it demonstrates that this model is durable and sustainable. House File 3114 recognizes expansion is on the horizon for school-based health centers in Minnesota. We want to make it sure it occurs with cost effectiveness, core competencies, equity, and evaluation. School-based clinics will assist the state with preparedness for crises like COVID, disruption of education disparities, addressing mental health needs, providing solutions in healthcare deserts, offering continuity for care for whole families, and even support growth of the healthcare workforce, which our testifiers will talk about today. Last, I just wanted to say that there was a federal bill that passed today that was signed by the president today that offers some funding to school-based health centers, but right now we only have two that would qualify for that funding among 17 federally qualified healthcare centers. So some of this effort will be to help those other FQHCs become prepared to accept that funding should they apply for it. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Headland. Okay, the next on my list is Linda Dick Olson.
Thank you, Welcome. Chairperson Liebling and committee members for allowing me to speak up in support for House File 3114. My name is Linda Dick Olson. I'm a therapist within our Health Start program at Minnesota Community Care, which is a community health center. I'm also the director of behavioral health for our organization. I started my career as a therapist on 9/11/2001 and spent my first day addressing that crisis with students. I know this model of care works. We use our team model of care to address the whole child's needs, keep kids in school, and improve their learning by offering mental health care that is equitable and accessible. In the first half of 2020, we worked hand in hand with school support staff, which is essential in school-based care, to provide students a needed connection during one of the most challenging times in our recent history. We were able to quickly pivot to provide telehealth care so that students and families were able to stay safe and continue to be supported. Once returning to schools, we responded to the elevated needs of the students walking through our doors and provided them with a place to heal and to learn healthy coping skills. I think of a young girl that I met right as the pandemic started who was referred to me due to anxiety. At the time, she was missing 3 of 5 days of each school week. During our telehealth sessions, she worked to identify triggers to her anxiety and learned how to manage her symptoms. Since returning to school, she went from missing 1 to 2 days a week that first month to not missing one single day during this last quarter. She is passing all of her classes and is getting A's and B's in most of them. She has made 2 new friends, which is a really big deal, and is learning how to speak up for herself. If we had not been there, her mother would have struggled to afford to take her elsewhere, and doing so would have meant that her mother would have missed work and the client would have missed school. The support we provide students in school helps them, their families, and their learning. Please consider passing House File 3114, which will provide funding to current and new school-based health initiatives, support quality care and equitable access for students, and formalize the relationship between Minnesota School-Based Health Alliance and the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Stephen Unowski. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Stephen Unowski. I'm the superintendent of Richfield Public Schools, and I'm here in support of House File 3114. I'm also here to talk to you about the Richfield Health Resource Center, which we felt so strongly about. We worked extremely hard to open without full direct funding from the state, and have worked with partners to make sure that we can give our students the services that they need. Our health center has been integral to our student and community wellness since 2017, providing medical services, health insurance navigation, telemental health, and dental services, all free or extremely low cost to students attending Richfield Public or within the entire city of Richfield, age 0 to 21. We have worked extremely hard with partners, including Park Nicollet, Portico HealthNet, Children's Dental Services, Planned Parenthood, and Bloomington Public Health, optimizing all of our contacts and resources to make sure that we're providing services to our kids. Our health center, despite COVID, has remained open one day a week and is returning back to 2 days a week soon. And we're a highly utilized health center with serving over 60 visits a month and over 700 visits per year each year of each of the last 5 years. Our health center partners with our school nurses, where it's important to note that our nurses partner, and we have supports in nursing in every single one of our buildings. And we also have our mental health services supported by our social workers, our actual employees, partnering in every single one of our buildings. What we all know is that students need to be healthy to be able to attend school and to learn effectively. Our academic results show that. Since our health center opened, we have some of the highest jumps in graduation rate in the state, jumping over 16 points and closing the achievement gap between white students and students of color by over 33 points, with all students graduating in the high 80%, almost 89% for both white students and students of color. And again, I want to note that we did this on our own, along with our partners, no direct state funding or support, just incredible efforts. As I look around at colleague districts and the needs that their students have, most districts won't be able to do this, won't be able to have the partners, contacts, and supports without your help and without the support from House File 3114. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Jessica Mihay, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jessica Mihay, and I'm the clinic director of Rise Up Health Clinics. We're a nurse-led nonprofit organization committed to providing equitable health care and services to children of any age in the school-based health center of Wiper Lake Area School District. In addition to my role at the clinic, I'm also an assistant professor of nursing at St. Catherine University. And in early 2020, we received grant funding from St. Kate's to begin a clinic and an academic practice partnership. So at the clinic, we utilize St. Kate's faculty as providers who oversee interprofessional post-secondary students during their clinical practicums. And as a team, faculty and students provide evidence-based accessible care to the students of White Bear Lake. So this partnership with St. Kate's supports the education, really, of the next generation of the healthcare workforce. Students from various programs at St. Kate's, such as pre-licensure nursing, nurse practitioner students, social work, occupational therapy, and public health, provide this interprofessional care. And their experience really broadens their knowledge of community health and solutions to improve practice and access to care. Serving the community produces a future workforce who will be more empathetic, aware, and driven to influence change within the community. Working side by side, pre-licensure students have the opportunity to learn from graduate level students, exploring what's next within their field. They're encouraged to continue their education journey and are more likely to do so when this comes from a peer. And then finally, utilizing post-secondary health students offers a unique opportunity for adolescent school-based health patients to explore health careers by observing and conversing with their student providers. This is really key in bridging adolescents to a future healthcare career. The partnership with St. Kate's has allowed for clinic sustainability and a cost-efficient method to providing care. Minnesota school-based health centers not only benefit the community they serve, but provide a potential solution to fragmented healthcare systems that negatively affect pediatric health. So thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And we'll go to member questions and discussion. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Sandell, for bringing this program forward. I think it makes a lot of sense. My question is about dental care. As you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about that. And Dr. Yanowski mentioned it in Richfield, but I'm wondering how that fits in with your program overall, if that's a built-in or if that's just something that we'll see as we go.
So let's see, should that go to Representative Sandell if you want to answer? Yeah. Go ahead.
Representative Ryer, thanks very much for that question. It's a really important issue that I've been concerned about since beginning to think about this issue. Frequently, we talk about health care and in very traditional ways, but dental care, sight, hearing are all very fundamental, as well as mental care. That is a fundamental element of this program, and it is defined, by the way, in the bill as well.
Okay. Representative Breyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Bierman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Representative Sandell for bringing this bill forward. As Dr. Mia just mentioned, we have a very fragmented health system in so many ways, and to bring this closer to the ground where teachers are struggling with students that need health care, to have this opportunity available is really, really important. So thank you for that. I wanted to ask Dr. Hedlund if she could just explain a little bit or define a little bit of the roles of the school versus the health center as far as administration and costs.
Great question, Representative Bierman. Ms. Hedlund.
Representative Bierman, Madam Chair, thank you for the question. One of the reasons that we think that this is a great opportunity to expand for Minnesota is that this is a very efficient model of care. Generally speaking, the care that's provided in the school is care that would otherwise be provided in that community. It's simply moved to a more accessible location in order to benefit students that might have barriers such as transportation or geography or family issues that create barriers for them and the care that they can access. In terms of costs, most of the costs that we see in healthcare are covered by reimbursement. And so Dr. Steve Unowski suggested that their students that pass through the healthcare center also potentially see Portico or another benefits navigator. We definitely, across our school-based health centers, attempt to ensure provide benefits for students and their whole family system so that most of those visits are reimbursable to the healthcare center, which reduces the costs the burden of costs to the schools sometimes as well. Likewise, we're talking about a population that's largely covered under Medicaid. And what we find is that there are even benefits to Medicaid itself, where there's school-based clinics in states, because it can reduce the costs of care over time because of more readily available care and reduce the trips to emergency rooms. One of the reasons we're coming to the the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee about this instead of the Education Committee is that we are committed to this, these costs not falling to the General Education Fund, because the General Education Fund pays for school nurses and for school social workers and allied wellness professionals that are employees of the school district, as Dr. Unowski also mentioned. So I have heard anecdotally from one of the schools that has the largest network of school-based clinics that their costs come down to custodial costs and administrative costs. The shared cost is sometimes a coordinator for care. That's sometimes also covered by full-service community school funding. We also know that there are full-service community schools that receive none of that funding, but they provide a wide range of wraparound services and a number of services for their students on private foundation funding and other sources such as local public health. There are about 6 different business models of school-based health centers in Minnesota, and this bill is written so that it continues to support all of those business models as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that comprehensive answer. And that's another thing I like about the model is that it's something that local communities can have such great input into and determine what their needs are and build off of that. And Madam Chair, if I may ask one more question of Dr. Anowski. You know, when Dr. Anowski, when you mentioned all of the services you are providing in Richfield, I just wondered if you started the clinic with that broad base or if you started a little smaller and built onto it over time, and if you could just talk about that.
Dr. Anowski.
Sure. Park Nicollet Foundation worked with us to build out a clinic to start with health. They actually also designed a telemental health room and also a dental room all at the same time. And so we actually began sort of in the first iteration in that first year with just medical, and then were able to continue rolling on with things. And so it's kind of medical and insurance. And then within the next school year or pretty immediately after, within 6 months, we opened up dental and telemental health right after.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one quick question more. So all of the services that are provided are available to students throughout the district. Is that correct?
It's students throughout the district and then birth to 21. And so open enrolled students to Richfield can have it. And then any 0 to 21 age child in Richfield can have it also.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Anowski.
All right. Thank you. And so that brings a question for me too, talking about the alternative or the full service schools. Could you just, maybe this for Ms. Hedlund, just give us a really brief, like, what's the interaction there? Would any of this funding be available to the schools? Is it a completely separate thing? Would it operate alongside and enhance, or how do you view that, Ms. Hedlund?
The Alliance is an affiliate of a national organization, the National School-Based Health Alliance, and nationally, Full Service Community Schools Coalition works side by side with school-based health centers, and the same is true here in Minnesota. The best way I can describe it is that if full service community schools were a wheel, sometimes a school-based health center is one of the spokes in that wheel. So that means to say that if a community who has full service community school funding identifies in their assessment of need that health care, whether it's dental, vision, telehealth, mental health therapy, or medical care are needed in the community, then they may open a school-based clinic inside of their school. And we do have many examples of that in Minnesota. And then there are school-based clinics that exist outside of full-service community schools. And then there are schools like Richfield that it operates much like a full-service community school. It just is not a recipient of that funding. So I think of this as a way to expand upon the opportunity for that full-service community school funding it's a replicable model without that funding.
Okay. All right. And so I think since I don't see any other questions, Representative Sandell, final word.
Madam Chair, I've had great partners working on this project. I taught school and coached high school athletics for more than 25 years. I've read lots of research on child development and learning theory. And my conclusions are those you've heard today, that the most predictable indicators of a child's engagement and success are his or her health, their well-being, and their aspirations. Some of our kids are lucky. Their health and confidence is secure. But all of our children, regardless of their background, can benefit from the services and assurance that SBHCs offer. And whether it's the individual school, as Dr. Nowski talked about, or schools that we haven't begun work in yet, we believe in the future, and we believe that this model is has great promise. So we hope that you can endorse and support this effort. Thanks very much, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Thank you, Representative Sandell, and thank you, testifiers. So House File 3114 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Okay, we're going to turn now to House File 3876. Representative Adelson is here, and she's not on our committee, so the chair will move that House File 3876 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. And then there is an A1 author's amendment, and I think this one maybe needs a little explanation. Representative Adelson, do you want to do that first before we vote on it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
What we're doing procedurally, maybe, and then we'll vote.
Madam Chair, the A2 amendment, this is an agency Office of Medical Cannabis bill. What we had is we had dropped three different provisions and we're just taking it for simplicity and rolling it, the other two amendments into this. And so I'll be happy to speak to the entire bill if you, the committee would adopt this. I would be grateful.
All right, thank you very much. So the chair is moving the A2-1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the A2-1 is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. 3876 is, as I said, an Office of Medical Cannabis agency bill, and they have worked tirelessly on this. So I actually would like to pass it to Chris Toks from the Office of Medical Cannabis to walk members through the bill.
All right. Ms. Toks, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Toks. I am the director of the Office of Medical Cannabis with the Minnesota Department of Health. I will walk you through the provisions that we're proposing. The first is the related to the medical cannabis paraphernalia. So it amends statute 152.22 and changes the term in the medical cannabis statute, a term from medical cannabis product to medical cannabis paraphernalia. Currently in practice, when we say medical cannabis product, we are referring to the medical cannabis or the medicine. And in statute, the way that medical, the way that product is used currently refers to a delivery device or a related supply to use in the administration of cannabis. The next proposed change is related to medical cannabis manufacturer registration, and it amends 152.25 subdivision 1. This strikes an obsolete date and instead requires a medical cannabis manufacturer as a condition of registration to begin supplying medical cannabis within 8 months of initial registration. The original legislation had a date of 2015 in statute. And it also requires the commissioner to implement a state centralized medical cannabis electronic database to monitor and track medical cannabis inventories from seed or clone source through cultivation, processing, testing, or distribution and disposal. It requires the manufacturers and laboratories to submit to the commissioner data needed to maintain the database. In 2021, the Minnesota Department of Health was allocated the resources to procure the track and trace system. There just was not a specific authorization for the system in the statute. Mm. It was part of the fiscal note. So this would close that for us. The next provision is related to commissioner duties, and it amends 152.27 subdivision 2. This subdivision governing the duties of the commissioner for the medical cannabis program, this would strike language authorizing a healthcare practitioner to certify that a patient is physically or developmentally disabled.
And okay, excuse me one second. You were just breaking up there. If you could just repeat that last one.
Sure. Maybe I'll turn my camera off too. That might help.
That might help. Yeah. Signal. It's been okay until just now when we are very hard to understand. Okay. Sorry.
Okay. So amending 152.27, this is subdivision 2 governing the duties of the commissioner for the medical cannabis program. It strikes language authorizing a healthcare practitioner to certify that a patient is physically or developmentally disabled and requires assistance in administering or obtaining medical cannabis. So indicating that they need a caregiver is what we call that in our program. A healthcare practitioner certification that a patient needs assistance is no longer needed. There was formerly a requirement for a patient to receive there was previously a requirement for a healthcare practitioner to determine that a patient needs a designated caregiver, but that requirement was removed in 2021. So this would align with that. The next change is related to the manufacturer requirements, and this amends 152.29 subdivision 1, and it changes a term used in the subdivision governing manufacturer operations from medical cannabis products to medical cannabis paraphernalia. So that's that first issue that we talked about. And then it requires a laboratory under contract with a manufacturer to collect medical cannabis samples from the manufacturer's production facility for testing, or that they can contract with a third party or other than the manufacturer to collect the samples for testing. This would require the cost of the collecting the samples to be paid for by the manufacturer. The current process is that the manufacturers collect their own samples and send them to the lab, and this would ensure consistency in sampling if we had the labs or a third party do the sampling, and the integrity of the program and just having a third party do the sample collection and send it to the lab. The next provision is related to the manufacturers again and the distribution, and it amends 152.29. It changes a term again related to governing distribution of medical cannabis, changes the term medical cannabis product to medical cannabis paraphernalia. The next section is related to transportation of medical cannabis and transport staffing. It amends 152.29 subdivision 3A, and it modifies the subdivision governing transportation of medical cannabis and staffing of transport vehicles. It would allow medical cannabis manufacturers to contract with a third party for armored car services to deliver medical cannabis to their distribution facilities. As a reminder, dry draw cannabis was added to the program and is available as of March 1st. And this increased the capacity of the manufacturers. So they just have more volume of plant and would like to have the option to be able to contract with a third party for transportation of product. It would also allow a third-party testing laboratory to staff a transport motor vehicle with one or more employees when transporting medical cannabis from a production facility to the testing lab. And it would allow the Department of Health staff to transport medical cannabis and other samples to the laboratory for testing and during special investigations if there's potential threat to public health, and would require that to transport the cannabis in the motor vehicle, it would need to be staffed by at least two Department of Health employees. And then lastly, it would allow a tribal medical cannabis program operated by a federally recognized Indian tribe located in Minnesota to transport samples of medical cannabis to a testing lab in the state. Same requirements to transport vehicles of at least two employees of the tribal medical cannabis program as well. And then it would also allow laboratories in the state requires transport. Oh, sorry. Yes, it would also require the two employees. The next section is related to patient duties, and it amends statute 152.30, a section establishing duties for patients registered in the medical cannabis program. Again, changes the term medical cannabis products to medical cannabis paraphernalia. And then similarly, there's a section 152.32 related to criminal and civil protections. It would again change the term medical cannabis products to medical cannabis paraphernalia. And then lastly, there is a section related to the impact assessment of medical cannabis therapeutic research. It would amend 152.36, a section establishing the task force on medical cannabis therapeutic research and establishing the duties. It strikes obsolete language, reports, initial appointments, and the task force first meeting.
Okay. Did we get to the end? Okay, yes. Very good. Thank you very much for that very thorough explanation. Are there any questions or discussion to the bill? Don't see any. Thank you very much, Ms. Tolkes. And Representative Adelson, any final word before we lay the bill over?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for carrying it. With that, House File 3876, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. And then Representative Adelson has House File 3119. And the chair will move that House File 3119 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Adelson to 3119.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House Bill 3119 is the result of hearing feedback from patients enrolled in the Minnesota Cannabis Program. Currently, the annual enrollment fee is $200. This bill reduces the annual fee to $40. This bill was a collaboration with the Medical Cannabis Task Force, the Office of Medical Cannabis, and the medical—and that's in patients, excuse me, my notes are off. For a little more context, patients with Social Security and disability currently pay a $50 annual fee. However, obtaining proof of Social Security disability status is paper intensive for patients and also the Office of Medical Cannabis. About half of the patients have Social Security or disability status. And so you can imagine this creates a great deal of work. I think we have 30,000 patients currently in the program. And as Chris Tokes has said, we March just rolled out the Flower program, which I want to thank your committee. We do expect a huge increase with the patient enrollment with that. So with this, as we were looking at the projections for this, it was rather conservative. So the Office of Medical Cannabis has always taken in more revenue than the expenses that it's paying for. So the fiscal sheet before you really, the numbers really do work with this. And I think it will be a huge plus to patients for the state of Minnesota. And since I've been elected over the past 4 years, we've really, this body has really done great work to improve our medical cannabis program. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would like to move to my testifier. I believe I have Marin with Sensible. There she is.
Right, there she is. Thank you very much. And so members testifiers, we have to adjourn at 4:30. So we have to be quick, but welcome to the committee, Ms. Schroeder.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. members of the Health Committee, my name is Marin Schroeder, and I'm a medical cannabis patient and the policy director for Sensible Change Minnesota, a nonprofit advocacy organization whose mission is to create safer communities through sensible policy changes. We have worked extensively on improving the medical cannabis program through the addition of new conditions and delivery methods, including driving the patient advocacy for the addition of flower for the last 3 years. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 3119, which reduces the fee. And we sincerely thank Representative Adelson for her continued patient advocacy and bringing forward this bill. Patients have consistently relayed to the legislature that the cost of being a medical cannabis patient is too high. This bill takes a big step to reducing that cost. This morning, I actually went to our Facebook patient group and asked how much patients paid to get into the program. On the low end, $53, low income fee, $3 copay. On the high end, $550 for two clinician visits and a $50 low income fee. There was also, I wasn't able to concern, but a $650 annual with the doctor's visits and the $200 registration fee. This is a simple fix that the legislature can take to relieve the financial burden on patients. I would be remiss, however, if I didn't bring up our organization's concern with continuing to increase the patient count when we only have two medical cannabis providers. With the addition of flower on March 1st, patients have had low purchase limits, long waits for pharmacist consultations, high prices, and many are still traveling to get to a patient center. While we're extremely supportive of this bill, we also acknowledge without further modifications, Minnesota's patients will continue to face affordability and supply challenges. Thank you, Representative Adelson, for bringing this bill and Chair Liebling for hearing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder, for all of your advocacy. And I know you've been very effective over the years, and it's great. Thank you. And Ms. Tolkis, did you want to also weigh in here on the bill? Welcome back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll just add a couple of things. I think most things have been covered already. I'd just like to say that currently Minnesota's annual patient enrollment fee is the highest in the nation. The numbers that are put before you to reduce the fee to $40 flat fee for all patients was recommended based on our historical revenue and expenses and looking forward to our projections. And as Representative Edelson said, we did try to be a little on the conservative side for our estimates so that we didn't end up in a negative situation. And we feel confident that that this fee it's the right time to reduce the fee and that it would not negatively impact the program. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Members, any questions or discussion? All right, not seeing any. So I'm so happy we've gotten to the point where medical cannabis is so non-controversial as it should be. So that's great. Well, thank you very much, Representative Edelson. We appreciate it and thank you, testifiers. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. So House File 3119 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So thank you very much. And so tomorrow we will be meeting. We have a number of bills on the schedule and we also will be meeting Friday this week. So as deadlines approach, we need to make sure that we get as many bills heard as we can. And so with that, members, I'm gonna give you back 4 minutes. So we stand adjourned. See you tomorrow.